Good morning, Matthew. Wonderful to see you. I'm afraid a sobering doubt for me. The threat of war in Asia, the reality of war in Europe, the trade version of it everywhere else. The future of global trade currently depends on a tussle between the American courts and the American president, who last night lashed out and doubled steel tariffs to 50%. Just like that. What does all this impulsivity do to trade and trade deals like ours? Meanwhile, speaking in Singapore a few hours ago, Trump's defense secretary, Pete Hegseth, issued a square-jawed threat to China not to mess militarily with Asia. That includes Taiwan. But did he go any further than his predecessors? We'll get reaction from Beijing. And for light relief, should our kids learn much more about AI?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, two adults and a teenager have died after a car crash on the M5 in South Gloucestershire. Police say a white BMW left the northbound carriageway just after 9 o'clock last night. Reporter Thea Rickard is following developments for LBC.
Another child is in a serious condition in hospital after a white BMW left the carriageway at around 9 o'clock last night. Avon and Somerset police believe all four victims were travelling in that vehicle. The M5 is still closed in both directions between junctions 13 and 14. Officers say the motorway will be shut for at least a few more hours.
The Defence Secretary says he has no doubt that military spending will reach 3% of GDP by 2034. John Healey has told a newspaper the target is no longer an ambition but a certainty. A major review of the armed forces is due to be published next week. The government has previously said that a 3% increase remains an ambition. A man's been arrested after a police officer was injured in an alleged hit-and-run in Greater Manchester. The officer was hurt in the Rush Home area last night. A 41-year-old man's been arrested on suspicion of assault, dangerous driving and failure to stop. President Trump says he'll double tariffs on steel and aluminium imports to the United States to 50% on Wednesday. The announcement is unaffected by a recent court ruling which sought to block some tariffs. Mr. Trump told a rally in Pennsylvania last night that the change will protect the domestic steel industry.
For generations, the name United States Steel was synonymous with greatness, and now it will again be synonymous with greatness. That's what it's going to be.
A government source says Britain will be exempt from the tariff after signing a trade deal with Washington earlier this month. And a team of international scientists say they've made a breakthrough in the treatment of some head and neck cancers. A trial tested the immunotherapy drug pembrolizumab that kept the cancers at bay for 5 years. That's compared to 30 months with standard care. Researchers say it also appeared to cut the risk of the disease returning in another part of the body. LBC weather: showers will linger across the north of England and Wales before clearing later. Dry with sunny spells elsewhere. Highs of 26 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
Have you ever wondered what becoming a lotto millionaire sounds like?
You want to sit down? I can confirm that you have won £1 million indeed.
That's Terry finding out he'd won £1 million.
Yes. Oh my God.
Lotto from the National Lottery. Will you be the next millionaire? Rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Matt Fry.
A very good morning to all of you, and for the next 2 hours, some questions. Should our pupils and students spend one third of their curriculum learning about the thing that might make them redundant in every sense, perhaps? And that is, of course, AI. Should we prepare ourselves for a new kind of war in cyberspace? And does the historic defence review published by the government on Monday live up to the hype? What should the Tory party do to stop it from becoming extinct? And what could reform do to make that happen? Learn how to add numbers up might help. How much further should we align ourselves with the EU? The governor of the Bank of England has said this week, we should for the sake of our hapless economy. But we start with Trump. Yes, Donald Trump. The dual threat of trade war across the globe and a new war in Asia. The former after Trump, who has locked horns with American courts over the legitimacy of his tariffs and suddenly announced doubling those on steel and aluminium to 50%, just like that. Listen.
A 25% increase. We're going to bring it from 25% to 50%, the tariffs on steel into the United States of America, which will even further secure the steel industry in the United States. Nobody's going to get around that.
Steel tariffs is red meat to the MAGA crowd. Who'd have thought it? And then there's the specter of real conflict in Asia, raised after the Defense Secretary, Pete Hegseth, said this at a conference in Singapore just a few hours ago.
China seeks to become a hegemonic power in Asia. It hopes to dominate and control too many parts of this vibrant and vital region. Through its massive military buildup and growing willingness to use military force to achieve its goals, including gray zone tactics and hybrid warfare, China has demonstrated that it wants to fundamentally alter the region's status quo. China uses its vast and sophisticated cyber capabilities to steal technology and attack critical infrastructure. But if deterrence fails, and if called upon by my commander in chief, we are prepared to do what the Department of Defense does best, to fight and win decisively.
The language is frothy, matching the tone and the appearance of America's Pentagon Ken, who, you will remember, started his job by scaring America's European allies and Ukraine. But in substance, what Hegseth said is not that much different to what was said by the Biden administration about Taiwan. But as so often, it is the tone and the apparent chaos that have put America's friends and allies on edge. So let's talk about this incredibly important relationship between China and America. And, of course, the linkage between military conflict, or the potential of it, especially over Taiwan, and trade. And let's call it what it is, a trade war. Two guests this morning, Sam Lowe, partner for the public policy agency Flint Global, who specialises in trade policy, a former member of the UK's government strategic trade advisory group, and Victor Gao, vice president of the Centre for China and Globalisation and the chair professor of Soochow University. Let's start with you, Victor. Thank you very much for coming back on the programme again. When you hear Pete Hegseth say what he said in Singapore, and of course what Trump said about trade war with China, what is your reaction?
Thank you very much for having me. Yes, the United States has launched the largest scale tariff war, or the trade war, not only against China, but against the rest of the world. Some Americans call the trade war as the economic nuclear war. So I tend to agree that this war should be stopped as quickly as possible by all of the world, as well as by the courts in the United States. As far as the Secretary of Defense, Mr. Hegseth, I would say he will not be able to fight against the megatrend of China's reunification with Taiwan. And the United States will never really decide to shed the blood of their soldiers and officers to defend the so-called separatism of Taiwan, because they will be involving in a civil war, which was now finished in 1949. And if the separatists in Taiwan want to push the edge of the envelope, it will cause the resurrection of the unfinished civil war. And between China and the United States, I don't think we are destined for war. I believe in the inevitability of peace between China and the United States. No one should agitate for war between China and the United States, because that will be mutual destruction and Armageddon for mankind.
But do you think that a trade war, which it looks as if China and the US are either having or might have, is the precursor to what could become a military conflict? Are those two issues linked?
Well, if we look back into history, on many occasions, trade war eventually lead to war. And I think the task for our generation to make sure that the trade war will be stopped peacefully, and the trade war, if continued, will not lead to a hot war, because a war between China and the United States will lead to mutual destruction and Armageddon for mankind. Nobody should want to be involved in the Armageddon of mankind. We should all work hard for peace. Let's embrace peace, and let's bring the trade war, which is a wrong war for the United States to fight, to an end as peacefully as possible.
But it's also a bad war for China to fight because of the domestic economic situation in China itself. You've gone from a housing bubble, which burst, you know, perilously, to a factory bubble, which requires you to sell the stuff that you make to your trading partners around the world, including, of course, the United States. So to what extent do you feel vulnerable by the trade war that has been raised by the United States?
First of all, China does not want to fight a trade war or a tariff with anyone, especially with the United States. However, if you look at the situation, the United States initiated the trade war. They imposed the trade war on China and the rest of the world. And the only thing China needs to do, which is the right thing, is to step up and defend free trade. And defending free trade is not just for the sake of China, it's for the sake of mankind. Now, comparing with any other country in the world, China is in the best condition right now. The piercing of the property bubble was initiated by the Chinese government. And after several years of restructuring, I think we've put the property bubble behind us. And China is highly organized right now, very much disciplined, and China can go forward with or without the United States.
What I've been reading, Victor, is that actually, far from being organized, the Chinese leadership is panicking because the domestic economic situation requires you to sell your stuff abroad. And if you can't sell it abroad, you're going to have real problems at home because you cannot replicate your foreign markets with a domestic market where, you know, Chinese citizens are just not prepared to pay the same amount of money or to spend any money on the stuff that Americans are buying, for instance.
I completely disagree with the proposition of your question, with due respect. I think ever since 2017, China has been readjusting its exports, and by now, China's export to the United States only account for about 13% of total Chinese export to the rest of the world. And China is now the largest trading nation with more than 140 countries in the world. Therefore, if you allow me to say one point, I think philosophically, we don't care if we are forced to lose out the US market. Why? Because we value freedom, we value free trade more than economic losses. I think the Chinese nation as a whole, being very much united, will be able to sustain whatever losses there are if we are shut out of the US market. But the quid pro quo is that the US will be shut out of the Chinese market. So President Trump and the US government need to ponder the real consequence of having China-US trade, bilateral trade, two-way trade, grinding to a halt. What will be the consequence for the American consumers? I think they will be panicking. There is no panicking in China at all.
Okay. Victor, stay on the line, please. I want to bring in Sam Lowe. Sam, when you hear what Victor Gao has been saying, when you hear about the rhetoric and, you know, and the fact of these steel tariffs just announced by Donald Trump, how worried are you that this will actually, you know, turn into a much more serious trade war than the one we've seen so far? Or is it a case of taco, as they like to say on Wall Street, Trump always chickens out?
So I'm not fully bought into this so-called taco hypothesis, because the premise is that Trump makes these big announcements and then he, as you say, chickens out and rolls it back in the following days. And this is true to an extent insofar as we saw, for example, the imposition of the Liberation Day reciprocal tariffs, which were very, very high. And then for many countries, and then a few days later, he rolled it back and said, we're actually just going to do 10% for everyone for now. But my point is that he still did the 10% for everyone. On cars, he's still done a 25% tariff on everyone. On steel, he's already done a 25% tariff on everyone. He's now threatening 50%. He's doing an investigation into pharmaceuticals, which could lead to a 25% tariff there. He's doing an investigation into semiconductors, more tariffs there. So while he does often chicken out, so to speak, from his biggest threats, he actually has reset the bar in a way. He sort of shifted the Overton window in terms of what we think is normal. And the average tariff rate of the US is going up and up and up. By the end of the presidency, I expect it to be on average around 15 to 20 percentage points higher than it was at the beginning. And I think that matters. And I think focusing on the idea he always chickens out misses the fact that he often does actually follow through
Maybe this is Wall Street's
threat.
Maybe this is Wall Street, you know, hopeful, you know, wishful thinking. How damaging has this chaos of tariffs been so far to the American economy and to the world economy? I mean, one day, you know, he announces 50%, then, I don't know, maybe 100%, then suddenly there's a reprieve. Is it 90 days? Is it 120 days? I mean, does anyone actually know where they stand at the moment? It's utterly confusing. And who's damaged more by this?
So it's created a huge amount of uncertainty for companies insofar as you can't necessarily invest on any given basis because you don't know what the economic parameters will be on a day-to-day basis. I mean, to give an example of this, when he announced the film tariffs, I'm not sure if you remembered this, we haven't actually seen
them. Oh yes, that was only last week, wasn't it?
yeah, so these haven't come into effect yet. But when he announced them, and this all of a sudden meant that people signing contracts all over the world to, say, film in a given country or hire studio space outside of the US paused. Because all of a sudden they think, well, our product somehow might get tariffs. So even though he didn't necessarily follow through from it, the uncertainty still has a cost. In terms of the impact on the US and the world, I'm still not sure we've fully seen this yet. And it will be multifaceted insofar as tariffs in the US could lead to inflation in the US. It could actually lead to deflation everywhere else. Going back to your previous conversation, as we see Chinese goods that otherwise would have entered the US being diverted elsewhere into other markets, which could push down prices in those markets and could lead to them imposing their own tariffs on China, which is, I suppose, this escalatory spiral that many people fear.
Victor Gao said earlier, and I'll get back to him in a minute, that China has an amazing capacity for pain and, you know, and for dealing with the economic consequences of a trade war, a greater capacity than America. Do you think that's accurate?
Well, maybe we'll find out. It does appear to me as if both the US and China viewed the Trump 145% tariffs and the Chinese response, which was slightly less but still over 100%, as being too much. You know, that was a pain point that was too much for both economies, which led to the negotiation that happened a couple of weeks ago and the reduction of the tariffs, which Trump has now threatened to reimpose. So I think there is a point at which it's too painful for both. I would assume that we're going to settle around a 30 to 40% tariff in both directions. And we should remember,
which
as
is
well,
a hell of a lot, by the way,
of tariffs already.
That's a lot, isn't it? 30-40%.
Yeah. I mean, there was already 100% tariff on Chinese electric vehicles going to the US. This has been going on for a while, so in a sense, this is an escalation of an existing trend. It's not the creation of it.
Okay, finally, to you, Victor. Taco, Trump always chickens out. Yes or no?
Well, I would give President Trump all the respect he deserves as the President of the United States. However, I think President Trump is very mischievous. His art of war really is the art of inflicting as much pain on everyone around him in the United States and outside of the United States. And President Trump has become the greatest unreliability, unpredictability, and a lack of reliability in the world of today. So we need to deal with him as he is, rather than blow him out of proportion. He is the greatest source of lack of reliability in the world of today.
Okay. And China may be a lot more reliable, but many people are also very unhappy with the way that China has conducted its trade, the way China's conducting military policy at the moment. So you're predictable, but scary.
Well, I think China is the major force for peace, and China is the standard bearer of free trade. The world should be proud of that.
You don't believe that, do you, Victor?
I do believe that.
I mean, you're great at producing stuff, but you've been cheating left, right, and center.
I want to be the bearer of the flag of the free trade for the sake of mankind, as well as for Britain.
Okay, just one more on Taiwan. I mean, the language used by Pete Hegseth was kind of frothy, but essentially he didn't even go as far as Biden did in terms of, you know, destroying America's strategic ambiguity over Taiwan. Do you think that at the end of the day, America might be persuade itself that intervening militarily in Taiwan is the right thing to do?
Well, we the Chinese always look at this starting from the philosophical point. Now, philosophically, it is against the fundamental interests of the American people to be involved in the so-called Taiwan separatist movement. It's absolutely against the United States government. The United States, if involved in supporting separatist movement in Taiwan, will be illegitimate in whatever they do. They will throw out the diplomatic relations between China and the United States out of the window. Therefore, they need to really ponder the consequence of what if they shut themselves out of the People's Republic of China and they become a force for Taiwanese separatists and they bring death to hundreds, if not hundreds of thousands of American soldiers and officers, for the sake of what?
For the sake
of supporting separatist movement in Taiwan?
There's also the question of what the Taiwanese people themselves want. But we'll leave that for another day, Victor. Got to leave it there. Victor Gao in Beijing, thank you very much. Sam Lowe in London, thanks to both of you for joining us. After the break, we're going to speak to the Canadian High Commissioner in the UK about Canada, 51st state in the United States, or ever stronger, more powerful country taking on America and trying to side with Europe. Listen, 0345-6060973 and call. I'm Matt Fry, this is LBC, the time is now 10:20.
LBC. In the time it takes to boil your kettle, you could find out if you can claim for a missold PCP agreement. Visit claimsforcars.com, answer a few easy questions, and you'll find out in seconds. If you financed a car between 2007 and 2021 and weren't shown different options or discussed dealer commission, you could have a claim. Claims for Cars is helping people get back thousands on a no-win, no-fee basis. Get the answer in seconds at claimsforcars.com.
Getting ready for summer? It's time to scrub the barbecue, mow the lawn and dust off the wine glasses. At Waitrose, we're getting ready with 25% off six or more bottles of wine or fizz over £6. Like a fruity San Leo Prosecco, perfect with aged Parma ham. Or a crisp Whispering Angel Rosé, ideal for your first barbecue. And our number one Chablis, the aromas of fresh peach pair beautifully with a seafood salad. Start the summer with some great savings at Waitrose. Selected stores online, subject to availability. Excludes Scotland, boxed wines and bottles priced £100 and over.
It's your home, darling. Let's make it fabulous. High scoring isn't my forte, but there's no arguing with Trustpilot ratings. Shutterly Fabulous have an expert team of fitters who specialise in one thing, simply gorgeous window shutters. Made to measure, hand-finished and expertly installed. Make your home Shutterly Fabulous. So don't diver, darling. Book a free consultation with our expert shutter fitters today.
Long, sunny days are ahead, and your next big win could be too. With massive cash prizes waiting to be won, your dream purchase may be closer than you think. But you've got to be in it to win it. Enter today at winplus.co.uk. Winplus, great prizes, real winners. 18 plus GB only, T's and C's apply.
Find out if you can claim compensation for a missold PCP agreement or a faulty DPF filter. Just visit claimsforcars.com and you'll get the answer in seconds. Matt Fry on LBC.
So one of the issues that has really kind of risen to the fore ever since Trump came to power, and my God, there have been many, is the issue of Canada. Now, we rarely spoke about Canada. Canada was, you know, in enormous space, you know, in North America. Canadians have an incredible reputation for being kind, sometimes perhaps erring on the side of boredom a little bit, but basically a benign, democratic, stable country. And suddenly Trump comes along and says, guess what? I think Canada should be the 51st state of the United States. And he said this more or less, you know, within hours of becoming president. He then suggested that, you know, if they didn't want to do this, if they didn't take up this very kind offer of inclusion, well, who knows what might happen to their trade and their security. And you know, you then wonder whether, to what extent, Canada fits in to Trump's vision of the world, the vision of geography, which is divided into these sort of vast spheres of influence, where, you know, China dominates Asia, Europe isn't, you know, let's say a work in progress between Russia and, you know, America's democratic allies in Central and Western Europe. And then you've got the United States that wants to be the big dog in the Western Hemisphere. Hence this emphasis on Canada, hence his flirtation with Greenland, hence, you know, the emphasis he put on the Panama Canal. If that's the case, what is the future of Canada? Well, if it hadn't been for Trump making those noises, then Mark Carney, the former governor of the Bank of England, probably wouldn't have been elected as Prime Minister of Canada recently, because his party, the Liberal Party, was floundering in the polls disastrously under the former Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. And had Trump not come along, then probably Carney wouldn't have gone into politics, and he certainly wouldn't be Prime Minister right now. Also, Carney, just a few days ago, said the West as we know it is over. The relationships, the benign relationship, and I'm paraphrasing here, with the United States and the global trade order that comes with that, as we know it, is also over. So these are really, you know, these are quite trenchant things to say. And my question is, where does Canada go from here? It's great to have the King opening Parliament, as he did just a few days ago, but it's weird to go back to a colonial past, or, you know, the spectre of a colonial past, when actually what we're really dealing with is the future of Canada in this brave, new and rather chaotic world. And of course, you can't get away from your geography. We learnt that here on the island after Brexit the hard way. Let's speak to Ralph Goodall, Canadian High Commissioner to the United Kingdom. Ralph, it's good to have you back on the programme.
Yeah, nice to be here. Good morning.
So the last time we spoke, Mark Carney wasn't Prime Minister. He was trying to be Prime Minister. He's now become Prime Minister. And in the kind of mixed martial arts routine of the Oval Office encounter with President Trump, he's done rather well, hasn't he?
I think that meeting landed well for Mr. Carney. Yes, indeed. Just as the opening of Parliament earlier this week with the King personally in the chair, that landed well too.
Why was that so important, the King turning up?
Well, this is the pinnacle moment in a democratic constitutional monarchy. A parliament has just been elected. A new prime minister is in place. And the head of state officially opens the next session of the full democratic process.
Yeah, but that hasn't happened since 1977, I think. The Queen was the last monarch in person to do that.
It's only happened three times, twice by Queen Elizabeth, 1957 and 1977. And then, of course, this week with King Charles. Slight footnote, as a former member of Parliament in Canada, I had the pleasure of being in the House of Commons in October of 1977, when Her Majesty the Queen opened a Canadian Parliament for the last time before this one.
Right, but the point is, by having the King there, and the King obviously was very happy to oblige, by having the King there sitting on, you know, his version of the throne in the Canadian Parliament to open it, that was sending a very clear message to the man who sometimes behaves as if he'd like to be King, one Donald J. Trump.
Well, it was the proper functioning of a free, independent, sovereign country for all the world to see, including our closest neighbour.
So you've got Mark Carney here, who doesn't mince his words, you know, who speaks truth to American power. And I just kind of paraphrase from the speech that he gave a few days ago. I mean, this is really quite extraordinary stuff from a Canadian head of government. You know, the global order, as we know it, is over. Relying on America is over. Lots of things are over. And of course, you know, he speaks for many other people in many other capitals around the world. But Canada is tied to the U.S., by the force of your geography. So where do you go from here?
Mr. Carney has, I think, described what you could say is that it's a terrible thing to waste a good crisis. We obviously have a crisis in terms of Canadian sovereignty, as well as economic circumstances and geopolitical circumstances around the world. And Canada, under Mr. Carney's leadership, is determined to play a very constructive role in that, a very pro-Canada role in that. And it includes defending our sovereignty unequivocally. It includes effectively dealing with this new relationship that we've got to sort out with the United States. And we're very early days in that process. But their first meeting was useful. They're due to meet again in the middle of June around the G7 meetings in Canada. So we'll see how the relationship has unfolded between the last time and this next time. And most critically, in the throne speech for this session of Parliament, Mr. Carney described the building out of the Canadian economy. We have been far too dependent on our relationship with the United States. It will always be an important relationship, but we've got to get rid of internal trade barriers. We've got to improve our regulatory process. We've got to get some big nation-building projects going across the country, investments in science, technology, innovation, and infrastructure, tax reforms that will encourage investment and growth, and more and more and more trade diversification so that we are doing business with more countries more successfully around the world. That's the broad agenda.
Right. And that's great on paper, but making that actually become reality is going to be tricky, isn't it? And so looking at the steel tariffs, for instance, 50% steel tariffs announced across the board, you know, yesterday, just like that, out of the blue by Donald Trump. Him lashing out once again. That, if they were to stay, that would have a massive impact on Canada, wouldn't it? Because steel is one of the things that you sell to the United States.
It would have a major impact, both on Canada and the United States. So far, with the steel and aluminum tariffs that are there already in the last couple of months, so far, steel prices have inflated in the United States by about 16%. So obviously, this is having a costly impact on the U.S. itself. Last time, when the United States imposed steel and aluminum tariffs back in 2018, 2019, the cost for defending each one of those steel jobs was $650,000 per job. And on the other side of the equation, the Americans lost 75,000 manufacturing jobs. So this policy has a very direct damaging impact in the United States too. And we will make it abundantly clear to the United States what those costs are. We will respond appropriately, making sure that whatever we do in reaction to this, and Mr. Carney has not commented since last night. Of course, it's still 5:30 in the morning in Ottawa, so give him a chance. But
he's about to get up, so you'll get your comment then, I'm sure. Yeah.
But he's always said when you calibrate countermeasures to tariffs, you need to make sure that you're having a more powerful impact in the other country than you are in your own country.
Just one more on defence. I mean, I know that Mark Carney's talking about joining the European defence programme, Rearm Europe, you know, somehow Canada getting involved in that. But again, I come back to the power of geography. You are next to the United States. Donald Trump has tantalizingly offered you participation in the so-called Golden Dome program. I mean, if he carries on like this, you know, he makes these offers, he makes these threats of you becoming the 51st state, and you suffer the economic consequences of a trade war with America, then gradually, despite all the rhetoric we're hearing out of Ottawa and Mark Carney, your position will become weaker and weaker, won't it?
It's a very difficult challenge for us, indeed. What you need in order to face up to this is complete Canadian cohesion and unity. And thus far, we've had that. Even through the election campaign, we had that. And that is a tribute to Canadians.
But down the line, in a couple of years, I mean, will it still be there?
Time will tell, but don't provoke Canadians. We didn't ask for this trade fight, but we've got our elbows up and we are determined to defend ourselves. And no one should underestimate the determination of Canadians when they're provoked in such an unfair and counterproductive fashion. Canada will stand up for itself, and we will have friends and allies in the world who will agree with us.
Indeed,
in the United States, most Americans agree with us.
In 20 seconds, are you more frightened of China's expansionist ambitions in the Arctic? And if, of course, you know, much of your territory is in the Arctic, or America's aggressive stance against you and against Greenland?
Well, you've got to walk and chew gum at the same time. We live in a very complicated, interrelated world. Every national leader, Mark Carney included, need to keep their eyes on all of those balls and make sure that Canada is playing the proper role. Indeed, the Arctic is important to us, it will be, I think, a major priority for Mr. Carney. He was born in the Northwest Territories. He knows that part of Canada very well. And I think you'll see greater emphasis on Arctic security, Arctic science, Arctic development under Mark Carney than perhaps you've ever seen before from a Canadian government.
Okay, Ralph Goodall, Canadian High Commissioner to the UK, thank you very much indeed for joining us. After the break, we're going to speak about Britain's role in the upcoming Ukraine peace talks. Yes, we've got a seat at the table. Isn't that wonderful? What difference will we make? We'll be speaking to Professor Sir Lawrence Friedman. He can, you know, zoom out and give us his view of the broader defence picture at the moment. And we'll be speaking about the defence review later in the programme as well. But for now, here on LBC at 10:33, it's time for the news headlines with Dominic Ellis.
Two adults and a teenager have died after a car crash on the M5 in South Gloucestershire. Police say a white BMW left the northbound carriageway between Junction 14 and the Michael Wood services last night. The Defence Secretary says he has no doubt that military spending will reach 3% of GDP by 2034. John Healey has told a newspaper that the target is no longer an ambition but a certainty. And President Trump says he'll double tariffs on steel and aluminium imports to the United States to 50% on Wednesday. Mr. Trump told a rally overnight the change will protect the American steel industry. LBC weather, showers in northern England and Wales will clear later, dry with sunny spells elsewhere, highs of 26 degrees.
This is LBC.
Big, big, big motoring world. Wow, wow, wow motoring world.
Yes, that's right. Big Motoring World is also Wow Motoring World because we price check our cars every day to guarantee you our best price with up to 95% of them below market value. Big Motoring World, we're big on what matters to you. See website for nearest store. Visit bigmotoringworld.co.uk or one of our stores for our price promise and terms and conditions.
People ask me, what's my good place? Checking out the food trucks on the weekend with my partner. And knowing that Pension B helped me combine my pensions into one easy-to-manage plan.
Tacos?
Tacos.
At Pension B, we believe that when your pension is in a good place, you're in a good place. Download the app or go to pensionb.com and be pension confident when investing your capital is at risk.
The Virgin Atlantic Holiday Sale is now on. This is your sign to taste Jamaican jerk chicken so good it brings a tear to your eye. Catch a New York basement gig worth the 10-block detour. Or hit the dunes in Dubai and find sand in your pockets for weeks. Seize the sale. Book in-store or online at Virgin Atlantic Holidays. Selected routes. For T's and C's, visit virginatlantic.com.
How likely is she to, you know, have another heart attack?
Can I still go to the gym after heart surgery?
Is my mum still my mum if she has a new heart?
When it comes to heart health, no question is too big or small. That's why British Heart Foundation have dedicated cardiac nurses you can speak to by phone, email, or online chat.
Hi, this is Chloe from British Heart Foundation. How can I help?
Search BHF Cardiac Nurses.
This is LBC with Matt Fry. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
So the field of defence, you know, and potential conflict is broad and confusing at the moment, to put it mildly. You've got the defence review here in the United Kingdom, which will be published by the government on Monday. We'll be speaking about that later in the programme. You've got the ongoing war in Ukraine, with a, you know, back and forth between the Kremlin and the White House about, you know, who's sincere about a ceasefire and who isn't. And then you've got the threat of potential conflict raised by Pete Hegseth, the US Secretary of Defense, in Singapore at a speech a few hours ago, especially around Taiwan. But I also suspect that what he was saying in that speech was, you know, the same message he sent to his European partners a couple of months ago: spend more of your own money on your defense because we're not going to be footing that bill. To try and make sense of this all, and it does matter because I'm afraid what happens on the front line doesn't stay on the front line. It'll wash up on our doorsteps financially or otherwise at some stage in the future. To make sense of it all, let's speak to Professor Sir Lawrence Friedman. He's the Emeritus Professor of War Studies at King's College in London and the co-author of a wonderful thread of comment on Substack. Anyway, Professor Sir Lawrence Friedman, good morning to you.
Hi.
Good to have you on the programme. So when you listen, I don't know if you saw the whole of that Hegseth speech. What was he essentially trying to say in his own inimitable style?
Well, I mean, he's saying what is not surprising. It's what the administration has been tending to, which is first that the Indo-Pacific is the area of real importance to the United States, and the Chinese threat is the one that they worry about more than they worry about the Russian threat, though the Russians are the only ones actively waging war at the moment, and that Taiwan is to the fore in this. The Chinese have certainly been building up their capabilities to take on Taiwan, but also, if necessary, the United States, and he wants allies to help. Mm. It's not a similar sort of message to Europe. Allies, he wants allies to do more. But I think the Americans expect to do quite a bit less in Europe, but they do expect to do more themselves in the Pacific.
Do you think that they believe in the White House that war with China can be avoided at the end of the day? And this, you know, they're kind of, you prepare for the worst and you hope for the best?
Yeah, I don't think that they see war as an inevitability, but the way the Pentagon tends to talk about these things, once it's fixed in your head that this is the big threat you've got to worry about, that's what you worry about, and that's what resources get devoted to. And I think there's concern that China has a pretty impressive manufacturing capacity now, so ships roll off and munitions come along, and the US is struggling really to pick up. So I think there's that concern behind it as well. But I don't think they see it as inevitable. And I think it's also important to keep in mind with Donald Trump that when it comes to the crunch, it's not that he's unwilling to use force, he's done it, but he tends to hesitate. I don't think he's particularly keen on a fight over Taiwan. It's just that's the basic scenario that everybody is focused on.
The thinking was that actually he's probably less keen on picking a fight over Taiwan because it's a fight over, if you like, democratic principles. And if he sees the world in terms of divided up in spheres of influence, then, you know, that's very much, you know, China's backyard, so China can deal with it. Is that accurate?
I think there's an element of that, but I think it's more that he sees the economic sphere as where he wants to wage his wars rather than the military sphere. I think he's all about tariffs and, as we've seen again yesterday, and about protecting US industry and dealing with Chinese unfair practices. I think these are the sorts of things that he's most bothered about. And in the end, it's up to Taiwan how well it manages its own defences. Trump is not keen on alliances. He's stuck with them, but he's not desperately keen on them.
And conquering Taiwan, I mean, it's a tiny little island compared to the Chinese landmass, but conquering Taiwan is no easy feat, is it?
Well, no, because you've got an amphibious operation if you're actually going to land there. The main thing that we've learned from Ukraine, hopefully learned from Ukraine, is it's actually very difficult to conquer places that don't want to be conquered. And whereas Russia had to come across the border, China's got to travel some distances where it'd be vulnerable. So that's why a lot of people suspect that if we did get to a stage of real tensions where China did decide it wanted to reunify by force, it would start with a blockade. It would just try and put Taiwan under siege rather than go straight in with a big surprise attack. And I think the Chinese also would be quite cautious, but they don't want anybody to think that they couldn't do it or wouldn't do it.
Now, moving to the war closer to home, the one in Ukraine, there's a lot of confusion, isn't there, around, you know, the developments, you know, on the diplomatic side. You've got, you know, Putin basically launching the worst drone attacks and missile attacks against Ukraine and its city since the beginning of the war. You've got Trump saying that, yeah, he still understands Putin, but, you know, Putin is behaving like a crazy guy and Trump would just walk away from it if there wasn't a deal. If you had to sum up where we are at the moment, how would you do that?
With difficulty, I think. But let's start with the point about what Trump was trying to do from the start was to get a ceasefire. I mean, I think that's how Trump views the natural way to end the war. The political issues behind the war can then be dealt with. Putin doesn't believe that. Putin wants to deal with all the political issues before he agrees to a ceasefire. And that's really what a lot of the dance has been about. Putin's supposed to come up with a memorandum if there are going to be talks on Monday in Istanbul, which will lay out what they want. Well, we said what he wants last June, he said it last December, he keeps on saying it in every discussion. He basically wants Ukraine to be to be disarmed, to be under in the Russian sphere of influence, to give territory that Russia hasn't been able to take. He wants all of those things.
And he's not changed that position, has he? That's been his position for a long time.
If there's any movement from that, that's quite interesting. But it's not what Trump wants, or indeed what Ukraine now wants. So I think we're the diplomatic dance, I suspect, will continue. I don't think Putin wants to end it completely. I think he probably realizes Trump's his best chance of finding a way out of this in terms which to some degree suit him, but he's pushed his luck. And I think Trump he can see that he's being taken advantage of. The issue then becomes sanctions. A Republican and Democrat senator, Senators Graham and Blumenthal, were in Kyiv, and they're pushing a very strongly supported Senate bill to increase sanctions on Russia, which provides Trump with a way of doing it if he's that angry and thinks it will do some good. So that's the next thing. And then the question after that, given that the war is likely to continue, will the US continue to give support? How much can the Europeans keep it going? How much can the Ukrainians themselves keep it going? I think they can and will, but it's tough.
So, you know, on the European side, things are kind of beginning to, form, as it were, but they're still a bit confusing. So Jonathan Powell, our national security advisor, is going to join the talks, I think, in Istanbul with the Europeans, you know, and then you've got the Russians there as well and the Americans. You know, General Kellogg, the Trump's envoy to Ukraine, has welcomed that. And it's kind of inevitable, I guess, that Britain should get more involved. You've got the Europeans making different kinds of noises. Trump, who was very anti-Europe at the beginning of all this, seems to be now more on side. Again, I'm confused here. Adam, perhaps you are as well. Where do we see the coherence of the Ukraine alliance when it comes to dealing with Russia?
Well, I think what you've got, one way to look at it is through two US envoys, Steve Witkoff, who was the one who went to Putin and was rather taken by the Russian president and repeated some of his talking points. And then Keith Kellogg, who talks to the Ukrainians, who understands the Ukrainian point of view and is probably happy to have the British, French and German national security advisors there as well, which I can't imagine Putin is very happy about. Witkoff is totally engaged at the moment with Gaza and Iran because Trump uses him for everything without necessarily producing much. So that leaves Kellogg so far leading the way, which is fine, I think, for Ukraine. Ukraine will be quite happy with that, but it doesn't necessarily mean that we'll get much progress. The Turks are playing quite an active role. The Turks are members of NATO, generally supportive of Ukraine, but Erdogan has got decent relations with Putin. So I think the Turks feel that if anybody can play some sort of intermediary role, they can as well. And the Turkish foreign minister has been quite busy over the last few days.
Just very briefly, do you think that NATO, the Western alliance, can actually maintain a shred of credibility if the wars in Ukraine, but also in Gaza, are not resolved sometime soon?
I think Gaza is relevant, it's obviously relevant in just a purely humanitarian way, but it's relevant to Trump. I don't think it's particularly a big issue for NATO as such. NATO has not made any pledges with regard to that. I think it's just a challenge for the international community and for Israel and the Palestinians. I mean, everybody's got to sort that out. I think Ukraine is a big challenge. It's one of keeping going. It's not that we sort of flunked it completely. It's just keep on doing enough and recognizing that for some reason, Putin seems prepared to put thousands of troops at risk a week almost in this war has achieved very little. People keep on talking as if the Russians somehow making great progress. They're not. Mm. They can hurt. They really hurt, but they don't make great progress on the ground, despite all that they throw at it. It's more a question of keeping going. Obviously, if Russia did make breakthroughs and Ukraine did collapse, that would be a real calamity for European security and would leave NATO with threadbare credibility, which is why I think the commitments have been made, at least by Britain, France, Germany, and others, that we can't let that happen. But that requires us to do more.
Indeed. And we shall watch that space, and we'll talk about the defence review in the next hour. Professor Lawrence Friedman, thank you very much indeed for coming on. And over all this, of course, hangs the threat or the potential of AI. In the next quarter of an hour, we're going to be speaking about whether AI should be taken much more seriously in schools and universities. I'm Matt Fry. This is LBC. The time is 10:48.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
The only way is up for the UK's military spending.
I can announce this government will begin the biggest sustained increase in defence spending since the end of the Cold War.
And now a pledge to go further, as the government promises to get off defence and publish the Strategic Defence Review. The Prime Minister says Britain needs to get fighting fit, but will his plan simply cause more offence?
Nick Ferrari at breakfast, back Monday morning from 7. Listen on your radio, on Global Player and the new LBC app.
With Little Plus Fruity Super Spin, simply shop and spin to win a free fresh fruit coupon with every shop. Download the Little Plus app to get by switching to the Retail Industry Awards Fresh Produce Retailer of the Year. 18 plus GB residents, various prizes available, subject to availability. Ends 4th of the 6/25. Full T's and C's apply. See little.co.uk/spin.
Next time you walk their dog or feed their cat, when you pop by for a cuppa or just stop for a chat, tell your friends about pension credit. They could be missing out on an average of over £4,000 per year to boost their pension income. Pension credit also unlocks other support like help with heating costs, council tax, and a free TV licence for people over 75. Tell them to search for pension credit on gov.uk. Pension credit. Credit where credit's due. Eligibility criteria apply.
How likely is she to, you know, have another heart attack?
Can I still go to the gym after heart surgery?
Is my mum still my mum if she has a new heart?
When it comes to heart health, no question is too big or small. That's why British Heart Foundation have dedicated cardiac nurses you can speak to by phone, email, or online chat.
Hi, this is Chloe from British Heart Foundation. How can I help?
Search BHF Cardiac Nurses.
The Virgin Atlantic Holiday Sale is now on. This is your sign to taste Jamaican jerk chicken so good it brings a tear to your eye. Catch a New York basement gig worth the 10-block detour. Or hit the dunes in Dubai and find sand in your pockets for weeks. Seize the sale. Book in-store or online at Virgin Atlantic Holidays. Selected routes. For T's and C's, visit virginatlantic.com.
At Wix, save on Dulux Standard 2.5-litre coloured emulsion. Was £23, now £15. Feel as proud as a peacock with Wix. Ends Wednesday. Terms apply.
This is LBC. Message Matt Fry on WhatsApp now. 0345 60 60 973.
So whenever we talk about global conflict, trade wars or real wars, you know, this is all terribly troubling stuff and your head spins and it hurts. And then you think, well, there's something else out there that we haven't talked about that we need to talk about. And that, of course, is AI. Artificial intelligence looms over everything. And now a professor and an economist who's written a book called A World Without Work, Daniel Susskind, speaking at the Hay Festival, has said the 3 R's of reading, writing and arithmetic need to be supplemented by a 4th R, and that is artificial intelligence. He said, at the moment in schools and universities, we should be spending a third of the time that we have with students teaching them of how to use these new technologies offered by AI. Whether there's an opportunity, whether there is peril, we simply don't know enough about it. And because AI is so transformative potentially, we should really be taking it much more seriously. A view also shared by Bridget Phillipson, the Education Secretary, writing on LBC on our in a commentary. She says exactly the same thing. We need to use AI in education far more to break down barriers to opportunities. Well, how does that actually work? What is the potential and what is the peril of AI? Professor Toby Walsh is the Professor of Artificial Intelligence at the University of New South Wales and the author of a new book called The Shortest History of AI. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning, Matt.
Good to speak to you. So is AI a peril or is it an opportunity? And do you think we should spend much more time at schools talking about it?
Well, I think most your commentators are right. It's an interesting, exciting opportunity. There is great potential. There's also great risk. Daniel Susskind is right in suggesting that this diagnosis that the world of work is to be about completely transformed, and we need to think about how education should change to deal with that. But I think he's completely wrong on the cure, which is we don't need to spend more time teaching people about artificial intelligence. Quite the opposite. The skills of the future, the things that make us humans special, different from machines, are not us trying to emulate them and understand them. Mm. It's us focusing on the things that the human characteristics, and this, I think, will appeal to your memories of your Oxford days, for example. It's, we need to teach people critical thinking skills. Mm. We need to teach them the humanities, English, history, modern languages, all of those things that make us more rounded individuals that will be able to bring the extra factor to the table that the machines are not doing.
I guess what he might be saying is that, yes, of course, you need to do all that, but at the same time, you need to also alert students and pupils to the shortcomings of the shortcuts of AI, because there are an awful lot of students now who just go to ChatGPT to write their essays. And in a sense, what AI does, what the temptation of AI does, is that it reduces your desire and your ability for critical thinking. And that is a big problem.
It is. I mean, we do have run the risk that we will dumb ourselves down, just as no one knows how to do subtraction or map reading these days. Those are skills that we've already outsourced to machines. If we outsource writing essays and thinking critically to machines, then we will be dumber for that. And that's something to worry about. In terms of the limitations of the machines as well, I mean, I can tell you, you don't need to spend a third of your education learning what those are. I can tell you exactly what the limitations of large language models are, which is if you want to prompt them, you prompt them in a very clear, explicit, declarative way, and then they'll do what you want to do. There was a while in the last year or so where people were saying prompt engineer was going to be one of the new jobs of the future. Well, it's not. As the machines get better, you have to speak to them in less and less precise ways. Mm. You and I mean, as an example, you and I didn't have to agree how we were going to talk. We're intelligent. We can understand the different varieties of ways that people come at us. Similarly, as the machines get smarter, we'll have to worry less and less about exactly how we talk to them. They'll understand us regardless.
And is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Oh, well, that's a good thing. I mean, there will be wonderful assistants, wonderful co-pilots, wonderful ways of augmenting our intelligence. As, the proviso being, as long as we don't allow ourselves to atrophy and dumb ourselves down by not exercising those critical thinking skills ourselves.
But isn't that the point?
But
when does augment become replace?
Well, that is something we have to worry about, and certainly we're already seeing some troubling trends in terms of entry-level jobs, in terms of even computer programmers. Already we're seeing worrying indication signs that some of those beginning jobs are starting to be replaced and automated, and then how people are going to get their foot on the ladder. Those are important conversations we need to have. But it's worth focusing on what distinguishes us from machines. It's our social intelligence, it's emotion intelligence, it's our creativity, it's our adaptability. Mm. Those are things that machines don't have. And I think, we have a unique advantage over the machines. I mean, a machine does not have a complex internal emotional life. we do. So we can understand each other. We can empathize with people. Mm. Because you can sit there and think, well, how is this person going to react if I say this critical thing to him? Because you've had critical things said to you and you know how you would react.
But on the other hand, you know, in the same way that automation was a threat to blue-collar jobs in factories, AI is a threat to white-collar jobs, you know, in offices, you know, whether you're analyzing data or you're crunching bills, you're crunching numbers. I mean, not all of us can thrive in an economy, you know, relying on our inherent human messiness and creativity. I mean, there's just not going to be enough jobs to go around.
That is something we do have to think about. And indeed, you know, it happened in the first Industrial Revolution. And if you look at what happened, we did actually share the benefits around. People forget the weekend was an invention of the first Industrial Revolution. And there's nothing about the earth going around the sun that demands that you get 2 days off every seven. That was workers starting in the northeast of England collectively bargained to get Sunday off to go to church, then Saturday afternoon off, then all of Saturday. And then I never understood this. And then at that point, we stopped asking for more. And, you know, there's no reason why we couldn't work 4 days a week. And there's interesting experiments going on in the UK, across Europe, in New Zealand and many other places, looking at what happens when you do allow people to work 4 days a week. And all these studies throw up two results. The first is that people are happier. Who would be surprised if people are? And secondly, people are just as productive. People do in the 4 days what they used to do in the five. They stop having, you know, bullshit meetings and get down to it. There's one strong caveat to this, which is there are certain jobs where this is possible. We should be very mindful. There are other professions, you know, whether it be nursing or teaching, where it may not be possible that people can actually only work four days a week. These are important conversations we need to have. We need to think about how we change society. We made some big structural changes to society the last time around in the Industrial Revolution. We introduced unions and labor laws and a welfare state and all of these things and universal education. So we're educated for whatever the new jobs were going to be to ensure that we all prospered. And I think we have to think equally radically this time again, because it's going to be another radical transformation with the additional challenge that this time it's going to be that much quicker. It's definitely unfolding at a much quicker rate.
And possibly more radical, very briefly, possibly more radical, because it's about the way we think, about the way the machines think, and not just about the way they produce stuff.
It is, because last time it was our muscles, and then that still left us with our brain power. This time it's the last thing that makes us special, which is our brain power. So yes, potentially very, very transformative. But I think the solution is not to make us more